Hey folks, today's episode was sponsored by Datadog. It's a cloud-scale monitoring and analytics platform. Datadog was built to bring clarity to complex dynamic applications in the cloud, on-premises, in containers, or wherever they run. With beautiful dashboards, distributed tracing, and seamless integrations with more than 200 technologies, including Azure and Docker and PagerDuty, Datadog provides deep end-to-end visibility into the health and performance of modern apps. Visualize key metrics, set alerts to identify anomalies, and collaborate with your team to troubleshoot and fix issues fast. I'd like you to try it yourself by starting a free 14-day trial today. Listeners of this podcast will also get a free Datadog t-shirt. Get started at bit.ly.com/datadogshirt. That's bit.ly.com/datadogshirt. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today I'm talking with Tara Raj. She is a program manager at Microsoft, and she owns the Windows subsystem for Linux. How's it going?
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for talking to me about this. Like, I'm a huge fan of this feature. This is the feature that I like to go and, like, if I talk to a group of people and I say, who here knows you can run, like, Linux natively on Windows, and, like, one hand goes up, but the rest of the people are like, what? And then I go to the Windows Store and search for Linux, and then it's like right there. I'm like, you can download Linux in the Windows Store. And then all of the, like, what's it like the 12 levels of grief? Like, people like denial, and then, you know, acceptance.
And it's great to see when people go through that process right in front of you.
Oh, yeah. And they're like, I don't want this to be true, but also I need it to be true. How do I feel about this? What should I do about this?
Yeah, it really is something else. And that's what makes working on this product so much fun.
So break it down. How long has this been out? I know that it was a beta for a while. I talked to some people who say, I tried it a minute ago. I didn't do what I wanted to do. Or I thought it was a beta. Like, break it down for me. Where is this feature and how do I get it?
Yeah, so basically, this was called, in its first generation, Bash on Windows. And that was released in May 2016 at Microsoft Build. And that's when it was first announced. And since then, it's evolved quite a bit. The beta tag came off about a year later. And now this is a fully supported feature. So you can actually install a distro from the Windows Store. We have a variety of flavors of Linux that you can get, ranging from Ubuntu to Debian to SUSE. And you install that from the Microsoft Store. And to actually get the underlying technology that lets you run these Linux binaries on Windows, you enable an optional Windows feature called the Windows Subsystem for Linux. So once you go, you enable that. You then install your favorite distro from the store, and then you're good to go to start using this command line environment.
Do I need to, like, turn on Hyper-V, or do I need Pro? Like, my wife has Windows Home. Can she run this?
Yeah, you can run this on any Windows SKU. And as long as it's the Windows 10 anniversary update or later, you're good to go. You don't need to enable Hyper-V or other optional features, just that Windows subsystem for Linux, or as we call it, WSL for short, since that's a bit of a mouthful. Once you enable that, you're good to go.
Okay. So WSL is anywhere, and that means it's on my wife's Surface laptop, or any, it doesn't matter the age of the machine. It's just simply if you have Windows 10 anniversary or up, or, or later. So if you basically, if you're running Windows Update on the regular, or it's getting run on the regular, you probably have this already.
That's right.
Okay. And you said that it doesn't need Hyper-V. So when it's running, like if I go run this, if I type start menu and I type bash and I hit enter and I type like Vim and I'm running Vim, it's not in a virtual machine, but it's still Linux.
That's right. And that's where really the magic of WSL comes in. So this is a lightweight command line environment that actually doesn't require the overhead of a virtual machine. So really the way to think about WSL is this underlying translation layer where we're taking Linux user mode, and that's the app that you're getting from the store. And then we take those syscalls and we translate them over into basically a way the Windows kernel can understand it. And that's what WSL does, is it allows for that translation.
Okay, so I'm trying to like translate this in my brain and paraphrase and also like come to terms. So we're going to watch me go through the 12 like levels of whatever during this podcast.
That's
which is cool, and I appreciate you like guiding me through my acceptance that the ultimately I will accept WSL as being a thing that I want.
Sure, in hope my life. So.
Okay, so if I write some code in whatever, C sharp or Java or C, and I say file.open, at some point, someone's got to go to the actual disk and look for the file and open the file, right? So there's all these layers of abstraction. And I know Windows 32, or what they call Win32 development, has the Win32 and then ultimately the kernel underneath it. So there's a file open that everybody uses to go and open files. And that's, you know, the what they call the Win32 API. That's a call into the system. Now, you use the term syscall, S-Y-S-C-A-L?
Yep.
And that's a Linux thing, or that's an operating system thing?
So this is more of an operating system thing. Mm-hmm. So what we're doing is Linux expects the underlying operating system architecture to be that of Linux. Mm. So we're putting this translation layer where when in user mode, you're trying to call the Linux operating system. Now this kernel component will actually take those syscalls and translate them into what the Windows operating system can understand. So then we can dig into your file system, IO, and things like that.
So if I say I want to do a file read syscall, that is going to ultimately get called, you know, get the work is going to get done by the kernel. But in this case, it's all Linux all the way down except for the actual kernel. Windows does the work.
That's correct. And so we actually use a technology that is called Pico processes. Mm-hmm. So we take each of those syscalls and we kind of packet them up in what we call a Pico process, which then the WSL layer of the kernel can translate into a Windows system call. And it's actually kind of interesting that this technology was created by Microsoft Research, and it's a project called Drawbridge, which essentially bridges the gap between the Linux and Windows kernels. And it powers many technologies that we use here at Microsoft, including SQL Server on Linux. And so we are also using this technology to make it possible to essentially take Linux and run it on Windows.
Okay, this is interesting. So like all of the neurons are starting to like fire and I'm attaching different things. Like you're probably familiar with the very old Wine project where people have, without looking at the Windows source code, made it so some Windows applications can run on Linux. The acronym Wine, W-I-N-E, actually means Wine is not an emulator. And then when someone calls a Win32 call, Wine will translate that into a POSIX call or an underlying operating system call. So when I go and say open, you know, like syscall to sys underscore open, you see it going by and you stop it before it gets to the Windows kernel, and you stop it before it gets to the Linux kernel, and Windows handles it. And there's really no Linux kernel at all. Like you didn't install the Linux kernel on the system, did you?
That's right. There is no Linux kernel on the system. We're just translating those calls as they come in right on the fly.
Ah. Well, that makes me think then, if I were maybe opening a file in the Linux and the WSL world and opening it in the Windows world at the same time, like let's say it was on my desktop, then because the kernel is ultimately the one that does the file opening, both Linux and Windows could be told that that file was already open, right? Which
That's
seems
correct.
Like a good thing.
Yeah. And you can communicate between the Linux world or the WSL environment that you're running, as well as the Windows world. So let's say you want to open up one of the projects that you're working on, let's say a Node application in Windows on your VS Code environment in Windows. You say code dot from WSL in that area path, and we actually open up that project for you in VS Code on Windows. But it's your Linux project.
Oh, okay. So then That's interesting. So if I type code dot whatever, that means that you in the Linux world, in the WSL world, have kind of added a kind of a path, you know, and when you see Linux attempt to and presumably fail to run a Windows executable, you just pass that word off to Windows itself.
Yeah, that's fundamentally what we're looking at here. And we call this interop, like that's the term that we've been using, where mm-hmm. you can go back and forth between your Windows and your Linux environment. And that's what makes this a little bit interesting, where when we're talking about virtualization, we think about virtual machines and containers. Mm-hmm. And I think the way you can think about WSL is somewhere in between the two, where you get this environment that is kind of container-like, but at the mm-hmm. same time, it's not sandboxed. You can go and reach outside of that container. You can go and look inside your Windows files or your Linux files, have executables going back and forth. So you can say from WSL notepad.exe and pull up a file in Notepad that's actually a Windows version of Notepad.
This is interesting. And I think I want to back up a minute, because when we talked about like the files as an example, let's not think about opening files as an example. Let's think about opening a port. If I opened up something in Node on WSL on, like, let's say localhost port 8080, and then I go out into Windows and I open up PowerShell and I try to open up port 8080 with like C#, that, because the kernel ultimately is always the Windows kernel, I would assume that Linux, or WSL rather, got there first. Therefore, it owns the port.
Yeah, that's correct. So it owns the port at that point. So really, you would only be able to open up that first application from WSL.
Which is kind of cool, actually. Like, the more that I realize that this is exactly what I would want. I would want to be able to go and run my Node app in WSL, open port 8080, then in Windows, open up my browser and go to localhost 8080, and I would expect it to just work. Because this is a part where it's kind of weird. Localhost in that context is my computer. I don't think of WSL as its own computer, even though it's its own operating system.
Right. And that's why I was saying it's a little bit different than a virtual machine, because you're sharing your IP address. You're looking at the same operating system at its core. And something that's really interesting here is talking about opening up a Node application in port 8080. Mm-hmm. When you do that, and let's say you're in VS Code on Windows, you're actually targeting a Linux version of Node. So if you have a production environment in Azure that runs Linux, you can actually test your application against that same Linux environment while still being on your Windows machine.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so then if I were using Node or .NET in my case, I would need to maintain my installations of Node and .NET and Python, et cetera, in two places. And I might want to make sure that I know about the versions that are in two places. I might have one version of Node in Windows and one in WSL. So I just need to be conscious of that.
That's right. Yeah, you should be conscious of not only the versions, but what you have installed. So WSL really is a separate environment. So it's not like all your NPM packages are going to follow you between Windows and WSL. We do have some tools to help you with that. We have a WSL ENV environment variable where you can create that in Windows so that you can do some sharing between the two, but that is defined by you.
Yeah, I've gotten myself into, you know, lowercase t trouble a couple of times where, like, I had a version of .NET like 2.1 in the Windows world, and I was working on something on my desktop. And then I went into WSL, and my desktop, or specifically my C drive, is available at /mount/C. So I was like, oh, I'll just keep working in Linux. And I went down /mount/C, users, Scott, desktop. But I didn't have .NET 2.1 in the WSL world, and I got all kinds of weird errors. And it took me, you know, a minute, 45 seconds to go, oh, yeah, I forgot to install the packages that I needed in this universe, or this user land, I guess would probably be the best way to put it.
Yeah, and I think that's great that you bring that up. So considering, let's backtrack a little bit, that you had to say mount/C. Mm. I'm guessing C was your system drive. Mm-hmm. So WSL really sees Windows as a mounted drive on top of this Linux user mode, right? And so that's why you have to go and say /mount/c. And then in addition to that, you're going into the Windows file system at that point. And there is a reason why we deliberately do this, as well as the way that the metadata of Linux files looks like and that of Windows files is rather different. And so we're kind of taking out the need for you to consciously consider metadata or case sensitivity, for example, by making it easy for you to create files on the Windows side of your file system and access those from WSL. It's a little bit more difficult to go from the Windows side and access your WSL files because of that metadata difference. And we want to make sure that we help customers and prevent you from corrupting files, for example.
Okay, so it sounds like you're saying, because I'm on a Windows machine, ultimately, because it's the Windows kernel that ultimately does the work, I should spend most of my time from a file system perspective in my data files, my code, whatever, all on Windows. Like, I can do that. I can put files and do stuff and put files over in the WSL world. But if I really want to share them, they need to stay on, quote unquote, C drive and not inside the Linux file system.
Yeah, preferably on that side of things. And you'll still be able to do what I had mentioned before, like targeting a Linux version of Node, even if your project is on the Windows side of things.
Okay, well, that doesn't sound too complicated. I can just have as many mount points as I want then.
Yeah. Yep. So we have the ability, if you want to mount USB, for example, you can do that too.
What about like network drives, like Samba or SMB?
Yeah, so many of those are possible. There is a little bit of a can of worms that you open when you try to use something like Samba, but for the most part, those are available.
Is it a can of worms that's worth interesting, or like we should talk about, or is it like a can of worms like it's complicated, or a can of worms like it doesn't work?
It's a combination of the latter two, where parts of it don't work, and then it is also a bit complicated.
Well, that brings up an interesting topic then. So let's talk about like what works and what doesn't. There are a whole list of syscalls, but I assume that someone could do some analysis, like file open is the one we use in an example, or port open. But then I assume that there's more obscure syscalls. And whether like how many syscalls are there in Linux? Are we talking about hundreds or thousands?
So I'm not entirely sure how many syscalls there are in total, but from a compatibility perspective, we're at about 85% coverage with WSL. And the reason for that goes back into our conversation about the translation and these Pico processes. We've had to go one by one and enable various syscalls, especially those that are not a straightforward one-to-one translation. So what we've done is we take the user feedback that we get, and we see which of these asks for syscalls comes to the top of the user voice asks or our GitHub repo where files have or issues have been filed. And so we go through those asks, and then based on how many people are asking for a specific syscall, then we go and implement that. So for example, one that is a recent ask that has really gained a lot of interest is for MSG get or message get. And that's a syscall that we don't have implemented yet, but because we have so many customers and their companies that rely on that messaging service syscall, we're going to go and put in the work to implement that. And it's definitely not a straightforward implementation. So that's why we hadn't had it before. But now that we have enough asks for it, we're sending our developer team out to go and help make that happen.
I see. Okay, so when you say 85%, that doesn't make me, that number doesn't seem super high. But at the same time, everything I've tried has worked. So that makes me think that the 85% that you did pick covers a lot. Like, it feels, as a user of WSL, you know, 90 plus, 95% plus. Like, I've literally never tried anything and had it fail, which means I must be using the top 85% of syscalls, not the more obscure ones. So the last 15% seems like it's long tail, perhaps more obscure stuff.
Yeah, and based on the user feedback that we've getting, I think that's a pretty accurate perception that it is more on the long tail there. We have a couple customers who've asked for things here and there, but if we haven't implemented it, chances are there haven't been a ton of asks for it.
Okay. But I'm over here at github.com/Microsoft/WSL. And I went, as you were talking, and looked up MSG GET. And I can see that, yeah, someone raised an issue. There is a discussion about it. And this is interesting. Someone said, reopening this issue, since this is the only piece of the System 5 family of system calls that is still unimplemented. So there's a lot of interesting discussion where they're saying, yeah, I'm going to use POSIX message queues. You know, there's justifications about it. Someone rolls in and says, yeah, we haven't quite done queue support. But like you're saying, and here's you just literally a month ago saying, yep, we're doing syscalls on a per need basis. And now we're seeing more and more people are asking for this. So how do you implement these? Is this something that I get with my regular Windows updates?
Yeah. So basically we have various rings of updates. The fastest of which is the Insiders Fast Ring. So the Windows Insiders program allows you to get updates a little bit quicker than the regular RTM update. Mm-hmm. So we push our changes to Windows Insiders. We look for quick customer feedback. And as you can see from our GitHub repo, it's super active. So we have a ton of customers giving us feedback. And based on that feedback, we iterate on the changes we've made and then roll it out to RTM.
Okay. So do I have to update my Linux to get that update, or I just have to just keep my Windows going and then like some syscall I want, it'll just show up one day and there it is?
Yeah. So you don't actually need to specifically update your, let's say, distro app, for example. Mm-hmm. It comes in through the Windows update. So WSL is tied to the operating system here. So when Windows updates, we update the WSL layer. Mm-hmm. Now, let's say Canonical has an update for Ubuntu's app in the store. Then you would need to go and update your app separately. So really, the store application or your flavor of Linux and WSL are two separate things. Mm-hmm. You just have them working together, but they have two different upgrade and update paths.
Okay. So then when I'm downloading, like, when I'm quote unquote downloading Linux from the store, I'm just getting the user land. I'm getting the zip file or a tar file or a gzip or whatever, an archive of Canonical's Ubuntu or whatever Linux I decided to get. I download it. It unfolds, you know, into the file system somewhere, right? Then WSL, the subsystem underneath it, handles the things for me. But if I go back to the store later and I see that that app has updated, that, and I'm putting app in air quotes, right? The app, I've already got Linux installed. Like, you can't really touch my Linux from the store, can you? What am I updating?
Yeah, so we don't touch your Linux from the store. We have you manually go and upgrade that because we know that you have various files and configuration settings that you want to keep. So if you do want to go and update your application, we have a way in which you can unregister your current version and then go and install that version. And this is through a command line tool we have called WSL config.
Okay. And I've got a machine where I installed all the Linuxes just to see, because I wanted to see if it was possible. It's kind of cool. I've actually got Ubuntu 16.04 and 18.04 on the same machine. And then I get to go and type WSL config /list and then set default. And the set default was really interesting because did that control what happens when I type bash?
Yeah, that does. So that actually controls what you do when you type bash, in the sense that when you say bash, let's say CMD, you say bash sudo apt-get kause. That'll actually install kause on your default distro. And that's what you've set as your default using that WSL config tool. And you can change that default at any time, especially let's say you're using Ubuntu for work, but Debian's your favorite distro for personal projects. You can easily flip back and forth between those two as your default.
Okay. So it's not a harmful thing in any way to run WSL config and switch defaults.
Nope. It's just a configuration setting, and it doesn't change either of those systems in any way.
Hey, friends, this is Scott. You know, listening to podcasts is a great way to keep up to date on technology, since we're always learning as software people. And you can also find a job by listening to a podcast if you check out our new sponsor, Hired.com. That's Hired.com/Hanselminutes. On Hired.com, software engineers can get interview requests from companies that want to hire you. Each offer will have the salary and the equity up front. You can view those interview requests and, you know, accept, reject, change the offer before even talking to a company. It's a great way to find out what's out there and maybe make a move. They're working with over 6,000 companies, from startups to large companies, from 14 major tech hubs throughout North America and Europe. What's great about this is it's totally free for software engineers. And if you get a job through Hired.com, they'll ordinarily give you a $300 thank you bonus. But if you use our special link, they'll double that bonus. So you will actually get paid $600 when you accept that job. Now, if you're not looking for a job, but you know someone who is, refer them to Hired.com/Hanselminutes, and they'll give you a lead bonus, a $1,337 bonus when they accept a job. So check them out at Hired.com/Hanselminutes. One of the things that was interesting when I gave a presentation recently to a bunch of, for lack of a better word, we'll call them oldies, people near or beyond retirement age that are still computer enthusiasts, I was talking to them about how Windows 10 supported Linux with WSL, and they were like, well, I already use Cygwin. Right, Cygwin. And the way I explained it, and maybe you can tell me if I did it correctly, was that Cygwin was a bunch of GNU utilities that were recompiled for Windows using that code, but they are ultimately on top of Windows. They're not updated as often. They're not Unix. They're utilities that have been portably compiled. But with WSL, I can actually like type dir in DOS, in quote unquote DOS, and say pipe, and then say bash and run it through grep, can't I? And I can pipe to and from Linux. And that seemed like a good reason to stop using Cygwin.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are two main advantages over Cygwin here. The first of which is just the user experience. Using WSL is just so much simpler. The way mm-hmm. that you configure things, and when you want to install a package, you use the native package manager. So in Ubuntu, you're using apt. And the other side of this is what you're saying, where these different utilities and tools and applications haven't been recompiled for Windows, and they haven't been recreated in any way. These are actual native Linux binaries that you're running on Windows.
So that means, like, and I want to be really crisp here, are you saying that you didn't change Ubuntu when you put it into the store? Or did you even put it in the store? Does Canonical put it in the store?
Canonical puts it in the store, so we work directly with them to get it there. And it hasn't been changed at all, for the most part. And we have a project that's open source. It's called the WSL Distro Launcher. And it's a template to allow our distro partners to take a Linux user mode image, essentially, and package that up as a tarball that can then be distributed through the store. And let's say there is a version of Linux, some sort of distro that you don't see in the store. You can actually use that template in the project to sideload your own custom distro on your machine. So if you want Alpine Linux, for example, you can go ahead and do that.
Interesting. So I could make an Alpine WSL, and could I give it to like people at my job?
Yeah, absolutely. All you need to do is have developer mode enabled so that you can sideload applications and you can distribute that like on your own. It's not official through the store, or you can put that just on your personal machine for yourself to use.
Huh. All right. Well, let me ask you this then. This is a little bit of a defensive question then. Well, why wouldn't I just use Docker and then bring up my Ubuntu's and my Alpines and my whatever's in a Docker thing? Like, why use Why use WSL and not Docker?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. And the main advantages here are that you get the interop between your Linux and your Windows environment.
Hmm.
And that's something that you wouldn't be able to do with a Docker image.
Yeah, so it's kind of like when I'm in a virtual machine, like I have an Ubuntu virtual machine that I fire up with Hyper-V. And to be frank, I'm forever trying to figure out how to copy files in and out of it. And I end up just, either FTPing or SFTPing things into it. Or there's different, secure copy ways, but it isn't a drag and drop kind of a situation to get stuff that you want into the virtual machine. And you always have that sense of, all right, what's my IP address? What's my computer name? What's my host name here and inside and outside? Once you start using WSL, it really is quite seamless.
Yeah, it's super smooth and it's well integrated between the two sides. And kind of a context thing here is that the actual Windows console is the shell around WSL. So when you pull up your Ubuntu image, it's going to look a lot like the command prompt. And that's because mm-hmm. the rendering and the actual shell itself is the Windows console. We're just using all of the WSL virtualization stack underneath that.
Ah, okay. So if I go and put in bash, I put in PowerShell, I put in cmd.exe, they are all the same thing. So when I click in the corner and say properties and I see that options font layout dialog that I always see with colors and stuff, it's the same across all of those three command prompts.
Yeah, exactly. And we did that pretty purposefully as well to make the user experience between these pretty seamless. Something that's kind of fun that I like to show with demos is that you can go into CMD and say Ubuntu. And then you look and see that, your colors will change a bit and you see that you're actually in WSL, but the shell itself is the CMD one. And it says, your Ubuntu username at home or whatever your setting is. And you can go back and forth between CMD and WSL in the same console window.
Oh, that's cool. So then there was a version of Windows Fast, the Insiders Fast that I was using that had a feature called Sets. And I guess Sets is coming sometime in the future. But basically it made Windows get like tabs. And then suddenly I could do tabs. Like Ubuntu and PowerShell and DOS all got tabs for free because it's all the same Chrome, for lack of a better word. The box, the console host is the same across everything.
Yeah, that's right. And we're working with the Tab Sets team to make sure that this experience going between the various consoles is one that's friendly.
Cool. So people can get this today. It is not in beta. But it is in constant development. You can check it out, the issues at GitHub/Microsoft/WSL. And folks can find you on Twitter and ask you WSL questions.
Yep. That's correct. So you can find me on Twitter at Tara_MSFT and feel free to tweet any questions, feedback, if you run into any issues. And you can find installation instructions at our docs page on docs.microsoft.com. And you can get to there by saying aka.ms/WSL.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Thanks for having me. It was great to see you go through the 12 steps and accept the fact that you can run Linux tools on Windows.
Yeah, I'm loving it. And I'm doing it every day. And I'm talking to random strangers on the train and telling them that they should do it as well, which is a little weird, but it's also fun to watch them go through the process as well.
That's great to hear. Thanks for having me, Scott.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.